I'd like to welcome you to the Michiana Adventist Forum, an independent affiliate of the Association of Adventist Forums. Happy Sabbath afternoon to you all. Our intrepid leaders, Drs. Art Robertson and Gary Gray, are gone today, so we will do our best to manage without them. Today's program is titled Studying the Book of Life, Adventism and the Need to Go Beyond a Blueprint Approach to Theology, presented by our own Dr. Manuela Castillegli. After the presentation, you will have a chance to join the discussion as Brian Strayer and tell me your name again, please.
Daryl.
They will run with the mic. Thank you. Thank you, Daryl. Daryl is helping us with our sound system today. As we begin our time together, Dr. Johnson will offer an opening prayer.
Lord, we thank thee for all good learning and for the opportunities to share it. Bless Dr. Castillegli this afternoon. Bless her mouth as she shares with us her wisdom. And bless our ears as we receive it. For Jesus' sake. Amen.
Just a few announcements first. Our next forum program is on April 16. And Brian, could you confirm that for me? I saw three different dates for that, but I think it's April 16.
I can't confirm it.
Okay. Well, this is, I think it's April 16, but keep your eyes out if you're on the mailing list. The other two dates weren't on a Sabbath afternoon at all, so I think the April 16 date must be the right one. And our speaker will be Dr. Niels-Erik Andreasen, president of Andrews University, soon to be our president emeritus, and professor of Old Testament studies at the Adventist Theological Seminary. He'll be sharing his reflections on his years in Adventist education. The 2016 National Adventist Forum Conference is taking place in Silver Spring, Maryland, September 16 to 18 of this year, and will be presented by Gregory Boyd. He was on our campus here just several months ago and gave a very provocative presentation. His title is Nonviolence and the Atonement. If you would like to receive email notification of future forum meetings, please add your name or give it to me, because I think our sign-up list didn't show up today. But just give me your name and email address, and I will make sure that that gets onto the list. Thank you to Terry Calkins and Debbie Robertson, who send out our publicity announcements and emails about our programs. Elisa Williams manages our Facebook page. Please explore. Go check out what's there. A lot of the previous presentations are on our webpage. Thank you also to Jim Harris, who usually does our recordings, and today to Daryl Lego, who is taking care of our audiovisual. We also want to thank those of you who are financially contributing to the forum chapter. The more you give, the more exciting speakers we promise to bring to you. Those of us who have grown up Adventist grew up hearing about the blueprint. And those who have the blueprint know exactly what it says. There were blueprints for lifestyle, for dress, for diet, and for other behaviors. And there was a blueprint for our theology. These blueprints were often presented as undiluted truth and an absolute standard. Dr. Yeagley will now present Studying the Book of Life, Adventism, and the Need to Go Beyond a Blueprint Approach to Theology. The time is yours.
Well, before starting, I will just clarify my perspective in a way. I am someone who is dedicated almost, I mean, more years than I would like to acknowledge probably, to the study of church life. I come from a background that is called the practical theology, which implies that I'm very, very focused on what the church lives as a reality. I'm very much interested in the reality of the church as individuals, fashioned, adapted, and subverted.
Since you mentioned your background, I forgot to give it.
I think everybody's received email, probably, but anyway.
I would be remiss in my job if I didn't read the introduction. Okay. Dr. Manuela Casiegli is a senior research associate with the Wellbeing at Work team in the Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame. Manuela received both her master's and PhD degree from King's College London. Her research area is practical theology with a specific focus on congregational studies, missiology, and youth ministry. She is also particularly interested in ecumenical spirituality and recently completed a research project on the Tizé community. Before joining the Wellbeing at Work team, Manuela was involved for almost two decades in ministerial education, that's what you were alluding to, as a faculty member of three different theological seminaries in Italy, France, and the United Kingdom. In this capacity, she also led the European Value Genesis Study, an international project aimed to study youth faith development within the Adventist Church. Manuela is married to Steve, who is Assistant Vice President for Student Life at Andrews University. They have a little Havanese dog, Chico, and they greatly enjoy traveling and discovering new cultures. Both Manuela and Steve are passionate cinephiles, and they love to explore the intersection between faith and culture, particularly through music, movies, and art. Now we know you. It's all yours.
Thank you. I didn't expect the Chico to be named here in this group. So, as I was mentioning, in my experience, I had participated in multiple research projects concerning the Adventist Church, but not only the Adventist Church. What the profile doesn't mention is that in my place, in a strange situation like the Mendoza College School for Business at Notre Dame, is due to the fact that we are participating in a study that involves more than 1,000 pastors at interdenominational level to understand the causes of failure or success in a pastoral career. So that is my current job. Now, having said that, just to explain my angle, my perspective in what we are going to see, you may understand that being focused on reality means also that blueprints sometimes are perceived as insufficient to explain reality. Reality is very much complex, and in all the studies that I have done so far, I've always seeing that what institutions say is one thing, one broad framework, and what people do, particularly youth, which is my specialization, is a very, very different thing. And that people use religion as a way to give meaning to their lives, to connect them to God, but in ways that are very personal and that not always respectful of what the institution says. They adapt, subvert, arrange based on what they need and the questions they concretely ask. So I started from the idea of blueprint. Didn't actually, having not lived in the United States, didn't know that blueprint was a code word in Adventist theology. And so I will apologize, but actually I think it will be quite on point on what I'm going to say. Speaking about blueprints, we may think that actually we are quite distant from the realm of theology. What have blueprints to do with theology? And particularly one realm in which blueprints are particularly important, architecture. And as we will see, I will use a couple of metaphors that have to do with architectures and architecture and buildings to try to understand if they have anything to do with theology and the way we build theology. Okay, so bear with me. The first definition of blueprints, as I said, has to do with the realm of architecture, but what we may soon discover if we start exploring this field is that not all blueprints are born equal. A contemporary architect whose name is Ole Scherer says, for instance, that in the last century, architecture has undergone a very, very dramatic shift. What is this shift? This shift is that concerns the fact that before, architecture was governed predominantly by function. Buildings needed to work, to be functional, effective, simple, minimal. Decoration was a bore because it was a waste of resources. Everything needed to be streamlined. The ultimate symbol of this kind of architecture was the skyscraper. You have there an example. It's all about vertical. But what is important is that architecture does not only imply a material dimension. It also implies values. And the values that underlie skyscrapers are profoundly hierarchical. It's all about who is at the top and who is at the bottom. Those at the top are always the best. Those at the bottom don't count that much. And architecture, in a way, was a way of enforcing this kind of hierarchical view of society. The taller you are, the penthouse, the better you are. And also, it seems, it is efficient, but it's also deeply isolating. People are stacked one upon the other without having the possibility, and they have a lot of privacy, but they don't have the possibility to connect much with each other. Okay. Beyond that, architecture, that means that architecture does not only create spaces, but also shapes ways of living and also of understanding reality. If you live, if you are an employee and you live in a building that is like that, you have a very clear sense of hierarchy. To go and see the boss, you have to go up. It's an enacted pedagogy, I will call, of values. You learn that there is something higher and more important because even your body has to move in that direction. Or you know that you are in a low position depending on the space you occupy in the building. Right? If you are at the very top, at the very bottom, or even in the basement, you know that actually you have a very, very simple and probably very marginal role in that organization. In this building or this kind of building signify to some extent a very individualistic and competitive kind of culture, and that is incarnated in the very structure. These values, it's not a mystery that in the last few decades these values have undergone a very sharp criticism. A deep crisis. And it doesn't seem coincidental at this stage that this kind of architecture has undergone also a deep crisis. So many architects today actually reject that kind of model. And so what happens? It happens that they're actually trying to create a completely different kinds of buildings. So this is an example. If architecture embodies values, is there a way to convey a different set of values, to teach people something different than individualism, isolation, competition, power, hierarchy? And so contemporary architects are trying to subvert this set of values, and they embody in architecture this kind of challenge. This first building is a building that was built in Beijing, China. It's one of the biggest buildings in the world. It doesn't look like that in the slides, but it's actually very, very big. And it was born in a space that, as you can see behind, was dominated by skyscrapers. All buildings that are perfectly equal, square, tall, and so on, all reflecting the same values that I have tried to highlight before. As you know, space is problematic in Asia, and the local culture, the very essence of the local culture is often all about conformity and hierarchy. So creating a building that was different actually challenged the local culture. In this case, you can see that architects have tried to balance vertical and horizontal and bring them together. They have created something completely different. As you can see in the drawing, it is like a loop. It is like a human body. Horizontal and vertical are almost the same. They are connected to each other. So they have, like a body, it has points where people work, but there are also veins that where energy flows and people can meet and work and discuss and exchanges. You may be starting wondering what this has to do with theology. Could we create a model of theology that is very much about meeting, flowing, having exchanges, dialogues? Could we challenge a kind of hierarchical model of theology? Let's see some other models of building that may challenge us to think. As we can see, hierarchies don't exist. In the second building that I want to show you, this is a complex, a beautiful complex called the Interlace. It has been built in Singapore. As you can see in the back, in the background, there are lots of skyscrapers there. The model of residential buildings in Singapore, where space is really, really precious, is the tower, the residential tower. But as for the skyscraper, it is a very hierarchical and discriminating kind of blueprint. It isolates people. There is very little space to connect. Buildings are put one next to the other, and what is in the middle is just nobody space. There is no life there. So in this case, what happened was that to challenge this this model and to create closeness, a connection among people, what the architect tried to achieve is to create something that was deeply interconnected and totally destroyed the model of the tower. You can see that it looks almost like it's a kind of set of Legos that have been distributed in a kind of random way. Well, as a matter of fact, if you saw them from above, they are distributed in hexagonal courts. So you have lots of little courts with spaces where people can swim, tennis courts, play, lawns, all sorts of things that actually create community. So the purpose of this building is, rather than isolating people, having spaces that allow people to connect and meet and have exchanges and interact with each other. Even the green areas are distributed in a way that is very democratic. You have them everywhere, not only at the top or at the bottom, but little spaces where people can meet and have constant interactions. So again, rather than being born from the vision of someone planning inside its office and trying to achieve something that was only and exclusively born out of a laboratory, this kind of project was conceived in dialogue with the reality of the people. What these architects try to achieve is to come into a dialogue with the people they have around them, understand their stories, their needs, and then try to shape the building based on what these people live and what these people need. So it's a grassroots kind of creation. It is really something that is open and tries to create a space of dialogue, including with the architect. The third and final building is probably my favorite. This has been built in Berlin, or is being currently actually being built in Berlin. It is called the collaborative cloud. If I had to imagine a shape, the shape of a building for our general conference, I think I would think about something like this. In this case, the architects, you can see that it's completely open. There is like a big gaping hole in the middle. Not only that, but it's also on the back, it is completely open. And in the middle, there is this big, big space where people can meet and exchange. Why I like this project? This project was born out of another practical problem, or the reflection of another kind of very, very practical problem. We are in a time when people don't necessarily need to be in an office. They can work from everywhere. So why should they go to an office? Well, the reason could be, for instance, that they can, in this building, they can reconcile both the possibility to have a very nice office and meeting others. Working from home, I do some working from home, is deeply isolating. So having a place where you can actually exchange perspective, work as a group, interconnect with others, even from different domains, is a great opportunity both for the company and for the person who works. So again, the design of a building that could be considered as a waste of space, or this big, big gaping space in the middle, speaks about collaboration, it is about open communication, it is about togetherness, it is about building a community as well. Just a step away from your office, so you have something that is always going on, a life of exchanges and interconnections that is constantly flowing. And again, another important point in this building, and that is it emerges from a dialogue with reality. It starts from reality, and it reconnects with the needs of the people who have to occupy that building. It's not just the concept of a crazy architect building blueprints in the isolated space of an office. Okay. So, what does all this have to do with theology? Because at this stage, you may be asking yourself, what is the implication or the application for theology? There are some similarities between architecture and theology. Architecture and the ways in which blueprints incarnate and enforce values constitute indeed a fascinating subject, as you have seen. Yet at this stage, you may be asking, what similarities? Architecture does not only concern the physical realm, they express also what we want to live in our lives. They are frames. And they shape our stories. If you live, and I've seen in many poor countries, if you live in big stacked buildings like those ones, those are the buildings where you can find the highest rates of criminality, isolation, and problems at many levels that you may imagine. Those, unless you live in a nice suburban part or in a nice downtown in Manhattan, those buildings often speak about isolation and poverty. So architecture is about framing life. It's about creating stories. And it can be oppressive or it can be liberating. It can speak about hierarchy, control, conformity, alienation, segregation, or it can express just the contrary, cooperation, open communication, creativity, interconnectedness, community. Also theological statements, theology, can be a powerful blueprint that shapes our life. In that sense, it constitutes a project that has a powerful role in regulating our behaviors, our decisions, our beliefs. Theological statements can be perceived as oppressing and controlling, or they can be perceived as open to listening, people's voices, and welcome their participation. The question I would like to ask at this stage is the following: how does Adventism create its theological blueprints? What values does its way of designing and using these blueprints incarnate and enforce? Is our way of conceiving and doing theology more like a skyscraper that emphasizes vertical authority and distancing from the bottom floor? Or is it rather similar to those holistic loops that were conceived out of an intentional dialogue with the reality of life? Do our theological blueprints invite participation or prioritize control and uniformity? And it's not a matter of either or, it is a matter of tension between the two. Actually, the temptation to build theological skyscrapers is not something that is unique to Adventist theology when that exists, but it is very, very common in Western theology in general, particularly modern Western theology. Particularly in the last 2 to 3 centuries, we have developed a way of doing theology for which, said it brutally, but the theology, practical life or life doesn't matter in theology. The more abstract, the more systematized and intellectualized is the account, the better it is. The more objective, the more refined intellectually, the power of theological statements is in the academic value or in the coherence, philosophical coherence. This move has led theology to neglect, for instance, taking into serious theological consideration the very nature of the church, of the Bible. Think about how the Bible is built. The scripture's dominant style is that of storytelling. It contains very few systematic or doctrinal descriptions. It mostly speaks about God through the narratives of his encounters with a wide range of very questionable people. Its longest book, the Psalms, gives expression to a scandalous variety of very, very incorrect feelings and experiences. And it's the farthest imaginable expression from clean and abstract systematizations. Biblical accounts do not often care about offering a neat solution for a problem. On the contrary, they invite you to find the solution of the riddle. The elements are there, but you are called to engage with the story, to discover them, rather than being just a passive bystander. Rather than dispensing truth in a well-packaged wrap, they provoke readers to look for God's path in the middle of life's messiness. Let's confess that. How many times have you wondered why God bore with people like David, like Abraham, and like a number of questionable and very, very imperfect people? And what is in their story that is particularly attractive and important for us in terms of theological truths? The four Gospels follow the same kind of line. They constitute another embodiment of this approach to God talk, or this form of theology. The person of Jesus is narrated from a plurality of perspectives, not just from one perspective. And by giving voice to multiple stories, the person of Christ has kept its relevance to a range of individuals in all times and in all spaces, including in our time. Any attempt at extracting a systematic account from this rich diversity inevitably impoverishes it. Does the form of the Bible, and not only its content in terms of abstract truths, have to teach us something about how we can do theology. That's the fact that it looks at diversity, at the particular and not at the general, to tell us something about how we should start, at least, thinking about the theology. So is theology, should theology be a skyscraper or a loop in this perspective? Should it be general and abstract, or should be people-specific or need-specific? The risks of building hierarchical blueprints like the one, like a theological skyscraper, are very, very important. And I want just to mention a couple of them. The first is the use of language. Because this kind of state, when we do theology, we try very often to create very general statements that where reality can fit almost in a kind of fence. We tend to use very, very general language. The language moves away from the concreteness of human life, and it becomes very, very abstract and systematized. Every word, if you have been in a committee and tried to create a theological statement, you know that every single word is carefully negotiated and have to have the agreement of every single party among those represented at the table. Because sometimes some of the parties are not really represented at the table. Every word it needs to be weighted. Institutional statements give at least the impression of aiming at protecting the church's position from the ambiguities and contradictions of real life. It's a fence that should protect the church from possible contradictions. In that sense, by taking a distance from real life, what happens is that, as in a skyscraper, when you are at the bottom, the life of the people who are at the you are at the top, the life of the people who are at the bottom really become very, very, very small. And in some way, we may risk also to lose completely sight of what is particular, local, lived, and in a way even painful in some cases. Statements are used in many cases as a hierarchical response, a patch put on the complexity of God's dealings with humankind. Rather than being inclusive, they aim at creating this kind of fence that controls reality. The second trait that theological skyscrapers may exhibit is the fact that they often work on around a single idea or concept. And that is called, it's a very simplified vision of reality. Reality is not always about one single idea, but it's about multiple ideas that may at the same time reconstruct facets of the same reality. So for instance, in the conversation, in the theological conversations we have, we often emphasize the idea that the essence of the Adventist church may be considered as equivalent to the idea of the remnant church. And the apocalyptic nature of the church is brought at the center, as if it was the definition of the very essence of Adventism. The emphasis on this apocalyptic identity has created a number of reactions. Even in our context, for instance, you have other narratives. Other groups have tried to rebalance the emphasis on the future and on what the church should be as a remnant with other narratives that have to do with Christ, Christ-centeredness. Think about, for instance, the One Project. And the attempt at bringing the attention into and focus on the reality of living in a Christ-like manner. So one single idea narrative, if it becomes extreme, can give birth to another single idea narrative that, and they are certainly complex and rich and important, but they need each other. And the risk is that if they are made absolutes, they may become reductionists their simplifying approach to what the church is about. Another problem with this kind of single idea narrative is the fact that sometimes they may not correspond to the needs of a specific context. That's the idea of remnant, or the idea of the church as all about Christ-like living, applying the same way in different contexts. Think about very poor countries, like Brazil, for instance, or in some parts of Brazil. Think about Canada, think about Germany, think about a number of places where actually we need a multiplicity of images of the church and not just one that may impose itself over all other narratives. The third trait of this tendency to build theological skyscrapers is the fact that sometimes these ideas become the norm. If the church does not look like the remnant, it should become like the remnant. So every effort is made for the church to be renewed, to be reformed, to become like an imagined idea of remnant, and we'll come to that in a minute. So the reality becomes a sort of empty or low-level kind of dimension. It is much less important than what is the ideal. The ideal is the super reality. And the real reality, what people live, is much less important. So it is more a kind of ideological account that becomes superimposed upon reality and where reality needs to fit, despite local needs, diversity, and a number of other issues that may be going on at local level. It is an agenda that is somehow becomes the ideal and the norm to measure the reality of the church. The fourth and last feature of theological skyscrapers is the fact that they tend to have reductionist readings of Adventist history. To validate an idea, a reading of the church, we often may be tempted to read the history of the church in a selective way to validate that. In our case, in some accounts at least, the remnant church is considered as the equivalent, or perfectly incarnated, for instance, by the church of the pioneers, the church of the time of Ellen White, that is considered the golden age of Adventism. Well, sort of, because if you look at that in a very, very careful way, you may realize that actually the church of that time had a lot of problems and doesn't look very similar to the kind of idealistic account that is often provided to validate certain forms or certain ideas of church. And in other areas, when we speak about the Adventist theology being all about Christ-centeredness, we may consider that, in fact, what is provided as a reading of the Adventist history is that everything since the beginning in the pioneers' writings was about Christ-centeredness and was about salvation by grace and a number of other concepts that are very current today. And well, it's not like that. In reality, our church was born out of an apocalyptical vision and then developed slowly to become something more mature. And the golden age probably at that time did not exist. And maybe the golden age is today, when we are more mature, more complex, and we have developed a certain perspective concerning our critical perspective concerning our theology. So competing narratives sometimes contend their space to be the space of the conversation to affirm the reality over the ideal. But what about the reality? What about those loops, that those spaces of conversation where actually reality may have a role in shaping what theology should be about? At this stage, we may consider that we have building a theological skyscraper may provide a lovely, safe, bird's eye view of reality. Reality is controlled. There is an ideal to achieve. And we have the illusion that actually we can shape life. Yet at the ground level, the life of the church may present a rather divergent and often painfully complex picture. As I've mentioned before, in the last two decades, I have often had to deal with the complexity of that reality. And in a way, I felt a little bit like those architects. I tried in my work to balance the view of the institution, the vertical view, and the view of those who lived with the statements or the theology that was elaborated at different levels in the institution. And often I had to face the distance between those two levels of the skyscraper. So how can we create something that works in a more circular, open, conversational way? Something that in which, just as the architects I've spoken about, in which vertical and horizontal are not in conflict with each other or are not distant like the ideal and the lower reality, but something that actually works together and can feed into each other's insides. In one of the studies in which I was involved, and this is just to give you an idea of the complexity of creating molds or creating blueprints that may be unified, we asked questions about the hermeneutics of the church. How should we read the Bible? One of the options was in a predominantly literalist way. As to say, the Bible should be read in the understood word by word in a literalist sense. The second option, what I call here historical, was a definition that worked like this. The Bible should be interpreted in light of the Adventist tradition and the writings of Ellen White. The third option was reader-oriented, as to say, everybody is arbiter of what the Bible means. It depends on the subject. It is completely and entirely left to the subject. There was a fourth option, it was the Bible should be interpreted in light of the historical and cultural circumstances of the time. As you can see from the map, the response was far from being univocal. I thought about bringing this to you because in the next few years, one of my main problems will be to measure our positions in discussions about how we should interpret the Bible, hermeneutics. Well, as you can see here, actually we are extremely divided. It's not a big discovery, as a matter of fact. You have extreme positions there. How to unify them? You have on one side, an extreme side, Portugal, which is all about literalist reading, word by word. The Bible explain it by itself, no external suggestion. You see Romania on the other side, which is the Bible should be interpreted in light of Ellen White's writings. And then you have other countries in mid-gray that have a more nuanced position, the Italy, Great Britain, and in the middle also you see southern Germany and other countries in the north who would have a more historical, cultural position to say the Bible should be interpreted on the basis of the history and culture of behind the text. And then you have the light, very light gray, that is all about There is no actually objective reference. The Bible's interpretation depends on the subject, is entirely subjective, and it depends also on the reader. Okay, how to solve a problem like this? With a single statement, or with a Bible commission, or a study commission. How can we reduce the diversity of different stories? These countries all have a culture, different perspectives, different traditions in the readings. How can we solve a problem like this? Second, little hint or provocation, if you want, or stimulation. This is what young people in Europe believe concerning Adventist doctrines. You have to read it horizontally rather than vertically. So we have depending on the division, here the people involved came from the Trans-European Division and the Euro-Africa Division. In the Trans-European Division, the first doctrine to be believed was the Second Coming, while in the Euro-Africa Division, it was the Ten Commandments. But then you had Sabbath, Baptism, Church, condition of the death. You see that there is a group that consistently come at the bottom, the Remnant, Ellen White, 1844, Same Faith Marriage. Also the millennium. Those doctrines were the least understood, and only about half of the sample, it was 6,000 young people, believed that they were actually true. They subscribed to them. Okay. So that group, the believing in that group of doctrine situated who could be considered as a conservative, mainstream, or liberal. Those doctrines were very low, identified also as a kind, as a, let's say, more progressive in terms of openness and discussion and debating about that kind of distinctive heritage. And other countries were more strict, and that the acceptance of those doctrines was high. So this is the portrait of the so-called European Adventism. You can't really speak about European Adventism. You can speak about European Adventisms, maybe, but not of European Adventism. And that's why I hesitate when I think about blueprints, because here the blueprint is seen in very different ways. So you have Romania, Portugal, Bulgaria, and Austria that are based on the belief on those doctrines go in on the conservative bucket, if you want. A mainstream group that is quite important, Norway, France, South Germany, Adriatic Union, which is the former Yugoslavia, Britain, Italy, and Czech and Slovakian Union, Switzerland, and then you have the extreme left countries that are characterized by very low belief or loyalty to those distinctive doctrines, Netherlands, Finland, Northern Germany, and Denmark. Blueprints, does that exist? And how should we respond to this diversity? Does the fact of enforcing a common blueprint solve the problem? In this case. One last example. Here it is. The question was a question that we asked to our young people, and at the same time was asked by a much, much bigger survey that was done in Europe, and it's called the European Values Survey. So we could measure up how our young people responded and how young people outside the church would respond. One element that was strikingly higher, as you can see, is the third from the top, and it's in response to a question like, would you agree having a homosexual person living in your neighborhood? Okay, and you can see that in the case of Adventist young people, the response was much, much lower than in the case of general society, okay? Remember, this has nothing to do with embracing homosexuality. It has to do with someone living in the same block, basically. So, and we noticed that what was going on was that in one or two particular countries, this rejection was extremely high. One of these countries was the Romanian Union. So we checked what happened, what was going on between the two positions, and we discovered that actually, when we measured the respective distance between the position of society on homosexuality and the position of the church on homosexuality, they went quite parallel. In the case of Romania, in particular, you see that they overlap. It's at the very right on your screen. You see that the position, the level of rejection of homosexuality in Romania in society at large is exactly overlapping that of the church. And not to be partial, but in the Netherlands, the high tolerance for homosexuality is also corresponds to a very high tolerance of society in general. The question would be, how much that is theology influenced by culture? Is theology sometimes a very thin layer of paint that is put on understandings that are inherited by culture, from culture? And how could we face this challenge? Because the needs, in terms of statements and theology, the needs of the church in Romania and the needs of the church in the Netherlands may be quite different. In one country, we have to fight homophobia. And in the other country, we have to fight probably a much too relaxed attitude. So there is no blueprint here. If we take just a statement, a very general worldwide statement, it can damage Romania because it can endorse homophobia, and it can be rejected by the Netherlands because they don't care. Okay, so you have to be really focused on and probably give more space to local theologies and to local responses. They may actually seize what is the reality of what is going on at a local level. As I said, no skyscrapers, more loops that are locally built, that give spaces to the analysis of reality and what is actually going on at that level. Okay? And I come towards the end. My humble proposal is for a model of theology that may actually be more spacious when it comes to contexts, more flexible than just a general and universally valid blueprint. In the case of Romania that I just illustrated, the contrast between Romania and the Netherlands in their position, it will work by starting. We cannot build a theology based just on our perceptions. We need to dig deeper. We should need to start from, first of all, asking the question. Theology is, first of all, about asking the right questions. And sometimes we ask the wrong questions and we formulate wrong theologies. So, what is going on really in Romania? Why such a high level of rejection of homosexuals? You could call correctly almost homophobic. And then you could come to maybe understand also what is that motivate that, the cultural context. You need to dig deeper to understand what are the dynamics. But Romania is a very patriarchal society, very conservative, deeply shaped both by the Orthodox Church and by a former communist regime. Very much about also conformity. So study the context and see what is actually going on there, why. And then reflect on the right theological answer. How can the scripture respond to this question, not about the general question about how to deal with homosexuality, but how to deal with the rejection of homosexuals in Romania in a specific context. What is the church tasked to do? Is that of just condemning homosexuality, or is that of fighting in a way that may actually eliminate the danger of violence against, because in that case homosexuals are beaten and persecuted, and let understand society that homosexuals are actually human beings that are loved by God and embraced by God. So what is the right theological, what is the right question, what is the right answer, and how can we be more faithful in our practice? So it is probably a relatively simple kind of model. It can work in a number of situations, not just with a survey that involves 6,000 young people. You can apply it in every single circumstance in which you have to make decisions. So too often we start from the rule and not from interrogating the context and understanding what is actually going on in place. My conclusion, very briefly, is the following. I would like the church to be very much like that building. It's a loop. It is a place where, yes, there is a structure, but there is also a big place in the middle that gives the possibility, give people the possibility to sit in different places, to connect with each other, to elaborate reflections, and to connect them to each other. Contextual responses that may be faithful to what is actually going on in the place where they are not skyscrapers. We may build the skyscrapers if you want, but only after having built a lot of loops in before that. A lot of responses that actually understand what are the challenges and the sins that we face in every single situation. That's my, and a place where open communication and diversity may not be rejected, but it may see actually as necessary, because only through communication and understanding of what is actually going on at the lower level, at the bottom level of the skyscraper, we can give relevant responses. Thank you.
I really like what you've said. I've been working on something similar for the last 4 or 5 years. I'll give you just a very brief way to compare what you're doing with what I'm doing. First of all, instead of using architecture as my basis, I have gone through the books that are published on science by popular science writers. And I have adopted 2 ideas from science as well as maybe what we would just call human studies. The first is that concerning the universe, it tolerates no contradictions, no false facts. But when it comes to the human being, although being material, we have to subject ourselves to a certain scientific perspective. We're full of contradictions. The things that matter most in our lives are not science, and it's not our jobs. It's not that we would spend one more hour a night at the office if we were given the chance. It's things that are relational. Love, appreciation of the arts of all kinds, music, universally traceable throughout all human beings, is that there are some things that matter most to us, and they're not hierarchical. They're basically relational. So if the things that matter most to us are artistic, then our religion is going to also have to express itself as art. And that means that when we go to the Bible, we're going to have to interpret as literature, which is art. At least this is a point that can be contradicted by many ways. But we'll look at the Bible as art. We're going to have to do something about the figure of God in that, because he is a king, and everybody is his subject. And the Bible is even constructed in a hierarchical fashion. The way it's canonized, everything about it has basically to be critiqued and expressed in human and contradictory ways. At the conclusion of that, we're going to be able to then go to some of our doctrines like the remnant, ideas like the incarnation, where God and man become one, or human beings become one. And that means that implicit from our science and our art and the things that matter most to us, human beings, one of the most important things is going to be the image of God, because the image of God and our humanity are both in one person, or in one being. We're both divine and we're human, and we've got to work out that expression. But that fits in very much with what you've been saying, I think. And I'd like to sometime dialogue with you on it.
Sure. Thank you.
I applaud your project. It's big picture theology. You never mentioned Foucault, but it seems that the hierarchical model that you are moving away from is very much a part of the European, the Western way. We are, our culture is extremely hierarchical. And I think, if anything, this vision of a more egalitarian, circular kind of a notion, it's surely something to aspire for, too. And we actually see it to some limited degree in the New Age movement. Sorry to bring that in here, because I don't want to sort of soil the waters. But I guess my question is, this is a great vision, but do you really, even as a church, our Seventh-day Adventist church, we are very committed, I think, to a hierarchical model. What do you see as a way forward, other than simply imagining it? You are a person who works on the ground. Do you think there is actually a way forward for this model in this culture at this time?
Well, it's a 1 million question. I think there may be. I think I'm very worried about the fact that if we try to keep a blueprint approach, a hierarchical blueprint approach to the solution of problems, we may actually fracture the church rather than uniting it. And what I would like to see more is a study of local realities, how they depend on I have shown there that there is a lot of culture going on in our theology. And that needs to be acknowledged. One of the missing elements in our conversation is how culture shapes our theology. We don't want to admit that that is a problem and needs to be faced, and that our views are complementary, are in a dialogical relationship to each other, but should not tend to create a kind of winner-loser kind of scenario, but more a kind of dialogical scenario. And my hope is that may become more and more a reality. In my teaching, I've tried to teach students to apply a different way of, I remember particularly one of the things that actually made me think, my work is actually worth something. A student who came from an African country, and he wanted to do a project, that it was an empirical project, trying to look for the reality of divorced African. In some African countries, divorce is becoming rampant, even in the Adventist church, and that is due to a number of issues. He was convinced that Western corruption was the reason why particularly women were resulting in divorce, asking divorce in a more big fashion. And I told him, why don't you look a little bit deeper in what may, that may. He was starting from a big rule. I told him, try to start from looking at reality. What he discovered eventually, and he had to challenge himself, because sometimes we need to challenge ourselves to see beyond. If I'm a Romanian studying my culture, I have to challenge myself to see what is going on. If I'm an Italian, the same. We need to break our barriers. What he discovered was that there was a lot going on in that culture. There was a lot of arranged marriages, a lot of child marriages. There were a lot of pressure and patriarchalism that was going on with males dominating women, and with the development of society, more education, and a number of other factors, women were just breaking the mold. So it was not Western corruption that was going on there. There was an entire movement that needed to be responded, and abuse, of course, a lot of domestic abuse. So how should we respond? Should we bash women for being corrupted by Western culture? Or should we actually care for creating a different family environment in which there is less domestic abuse, there is less forced marriage, there is less arranged marriage, and there is more respect for individual freedom? So I think that student was actually changed by that study, because he started discovering that actually he should not start from rules, he should start from asking the right questions.
So on a note of hope, this slide you up here actually has a resemblance to the inside of the General Conference in Washington, D.C. I'm not saying it operates that way all of the time or most of the time, but it's built in that way. I think that what you've said is right, but we live in an age of extremes where one extreme exists and we experience it. At the same time, the other extreme is very much on offer. So in North America, the biggest churches are actually congregational churches. You know, the mega churches typically exist in worlds of their own. They have a large sense of community. They emphasize the individual, but they don't have connections with other churches, even in North America and certainly overseas. And so we've always valued this in-between space. Our pioneers were against papal hierarchy. We fought the division conferences were an implementation to prevent hierarchy. But your critique, if taken enthusiastically and thoughtlessly, could push people to the opposite extreme fairly easily because it exists. What would you say in your talk to avoiding that happening? How do we take into account local conditions and yet still have a worldwide church with shared beliefs? And maybe you could speak to that for a moment.
Yes, that I think it's an extremely relevant question, actually, because at the moment, it looks to me, from my very limited perspective, that we have a dominance of, we try to keep it together. And that theology is a way for us to keep it together. We need to find a balance, because at the moment, local realities are not really legitimized to do theology on their own. They have no authority to shape. They are doing it anyway, okay? But it's happening under the radar. So, and officially it is happening. We have, when we speak about lack of unity, theologically speaking, we know that that does not exist to the same extent when that we mean it. In Africa, they had to adjust to culture and practical problems. In Europe, we have to adjust to practical problems and situations. So we have elaborated local theologies. The problem is that we don't speak about those. We don't dare to speak about those, because that will break the myth of unity. Maybe we need to articulate aloud somewhere from an authoritative pulpit that actually we need to start a conversation and admit that we are different, rather than keeping the rhetoric of unity in the way we may have done in the past. Okay, so I think that there needs to be a balance, and I think that an organ like a General Conference is a precious resource for that. I personally, my suggestion, and I don't think it will be ever accepted, but is that it may evolve in a more federational, the General Conference should work as a federation of divisions, in which divisions have more weight including theologically, and then they come around a table with a chair, not a president, and there is a conversation in which we try to find an agreement without being scandalized that we are different. That would be my response. So keeping it together, but with a realistic understanding that as a matter of fact, we are different and we need to respect each other. And I don't know if this is a myth or a fairy tale, but that will be my response.
So in some ways, we need to acknowledge what we're already doing.
Yes.
And bring it to a level of actual theology.
Yeah, yes.
Thank you for your presentation.
Yes.
I appreciate your willingness to look at the reality of our church and not only at some of the ideals that we tend to perpetuate without sometimes seeing the reality. And in Europe, it's fascinating to see what you showed us, how our young people either conform or differ from, no, the other one, the next one. Yes, or differ from the culture, and the extreme example of Romania versus Denmark or the Netherlands is very interesting. Now, I was just wondering, here we are at Andrews University, we're literally getting students from all over the world that will become the theology teachers of the future. We're shaping their minds. Do you have any counsel for, I will say us, even though I don't work at the seminary, how we can help these students from all around the world to come to grips with their cultural, I would almost say captivity to a certain extent, mm-hmm. or a reaction against the culture, and how would you know, the way we teach right now is really more the skyscraper model. We look for the systematic idea, philosophically coherent, etc., etc. So how would you create a conversation that is without giving the impression that we are throwing out, quote, the truth?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Well, I think one of the first things that should happen in the Adventist seminaries in Italy, in France, and in England, and I always found a major problem, a major divide between those who had to care for practice among the teachers and those who had to care about the theological skyscraper. They didn't really communicate very effectively. And in fact, in some cases, the complaint was, here it's all about practitioners or people or missiologists are those who care for the reality. We have to care about the very important things from the part of the systematicians and the biblical theologians. Okay. So I think one of the richest experiences that I had were the moment in which we had to co-teach a class. And we had to put it together. And the biblical theologians or systematicians and practitioners had to dialogue with each other to shape the class. And the cultural problem, I mean, in my experience, there is, you may actually have a much more, I mean, much richer suggestions than I have. In my experience, what works is to let students discover their cultural specificity in their life first, by talking to each other, by letting them discover how this colleague or this person does things like celebrating the Sabbath, serving food, dealing with women or younger individuals. Cultures, at Newbold, for instance, we had African students and Scandinavian students. Scandinavian girls were, young women were outraged by hearing what African women will do, like bowing down to serve food or to men or young people squatting because the elder was crossing the road. So But beyond the outrage, I think the most important realization was that eventually each other explained the culture of each other. And so they came to a common understanding and at the same time to the realization that we are all different. We do even Sabbath in a different way. And I was very surprised sometimes for realizing that some students believed that Sabbath was uniformly observed in every single part of the world, doing all the same things. And actually, no, there are people who spent all their day in the church and even sleep in the church in some places because they come from very far away places, and other people who actually would spend the least time possible within the church because they want to rest, sleep, having time with the families, and so on. So I think that coming from a respectful realization of our diversity is possibly the first step, even when it comes to theology. I may be wrong, but I think that the discovery of culture is probably the biggest challenge that we have with our young people when they train to become pastors.
I like your vision. Here's the question that comes to me. I went to professional meetings in Nashville, Tennessee one time, and it was held in a building where any kind of rectilinearity was absent. It was very disorienting. It was hard to find anything.
You speak about the building, or you speak about the conversation?
The building was, this is an architectural thing. I think what your vision allows us to do is to survive in an atmosphere of Western modernity. But I'm struck by the fact that the Seventh-day Adventist Church in Romania is the most rapidly growing, or at least has been, most rapidly growing, and the most vital Adventist church in Europe. In fact, a lot of the Adventists in other countries are really Romanians. They're part of a Romanian diaspora. While in Denmark, the church is on life support.
That's true.
I'm trying to figure out whether Adventism can survive on the kind of model that you you describe, or whether the fact is that we're having a hard time surviving because we don't follow that model. But I think average people are uncomfortable with the kind of disorientation and seeming relativism that what you describe seems to present. How do you respond to that practicality?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was not trying to advocate for a Netherlands model or for a Romanian model, really. I was trying to say that in this specific context, that suggests that there is, on one side, a very homophobic attitude, and on the other side, an extremely tolerant attitude, we may need different responses. So I'm not trying to say that we don't need blueprints, but that we need the right blueprint for each situation at local level. And so that what needs to be said in the name of the gospel in Romania may be quite different from what needs to be said in the Netherlands. In terms of the same issues. Is that a partial response to what you said? I understand what the fact that numbers speak a lot about or are very appealing when it comes to the success or lack of success of a certain country. I think Romania, the numerical success of Romania needs to be explained based on the context that is unique, and it's very different from countries like the Netherlands or Denmark, which are extremely secularized, and when religious in general disappearing, not only Adventism. In Romania, you have a post-communist country where religion was relatively under the radar for a long, long time. And Adventism has come, and we will need a really a lot of more study to actually understand what is going on and why Adventism is so successful. But Adventism gives a structure to life that has allowed many church members to raise it from poverty to a decent life, level of life. So it's about dignity, it's about structure, it's about giving an order to life. That is my interpretation, and I will need to do more study to give you the perfect solution of why Romania is numerically successful and why Denmark is not successful. That it, I wouldn't say that it is for lack of will or energy from the two sides, that one is successful and one is less successful, because Denmark has been a pioneer in trying to plant church, to invest a lot of money, to try to keep the church alive, and they have not been successful because the culture itself is very resistant to organized religion. So I don't know if my blueprint model could go to the detriment or to the advantage of the two situations. But what I am advocating is really, let's try to be attentive to local realities when we give responses to specific problems like this, for instance.
I'm over here, sorry.
Yes.
I've enjoyed your presentation. In the last couple of years, I've looked around to try to figure out what's really going on and why. And I've concluded that all tangibles sit on real estate and all intangibles rest on attitude. Blueprints here generally are developed by architects. And if you want a good example for a blueprint that wasn't followed to real disaster, there's a hotel that either they're in the process or have completed the tearing down because somebody didn't follow the blueprint. Very major, multi-billion dollar project. Now, blueprints are basically based on science, I believe. And architects use and study science in order to accomplish a specific desired result. Now, in a former life, I was an accountant. And accountants do compilations. And whenever somebody asked me to do a financial statement for them, I would ask them what they wanted to use it for, what the desired purpose was, and I would compile the information in a certain way that if I could, within the guidelines of GAAP and others, that I could achieve the desired result. Now, the problem I think here is that maybe we're not talking about science, we're talking about culture. And so the blueprint, maybe the reason why it doesn't work is because we're using the wrong metaphor or whatever. But I think that if we really understand why things are working the way they are, I don't think the culture is going to be fixed. And but a compilation can be changed as needed.
We'll make that our last question.
My grandfather was Romanian. He came from Romania when he was 16 to the United States of America, and he converted while here to Adventism. But this was helpful, helped me to understand why my grandfather was so rigid. Maybe my people, I'm Californian more than anything else, so maybe a little bit different Adventism, but I'm glad my culture as well as my Adventism is not defined by one belief, which is not really even theological. So yes, it's homosexuality is the issue, but theologically, and I growing up in the where I saw a lot of my Adventism Yugoslavian friends, we had reform, very rigid, I thought, and different experiences, and there's a period I got rigid, my brothers weren't very rigid, so I don't know if it's part of our culture. But as I'm thinking about all this, I think there's a balance between the congregational view and contextualization. Because in a sense, if you were to encourage the Romanian Union to have their own theological center, and they do, I guess, and they didn't get exposure to others, we wouldn't be more modified by the beliefs and ideas of others. And so in a sense, yes, there's an artificial uniformity, but there's also what you just call, you know, I'm married to a Norwegian now, and you know, it's quite liberating. And so I guess I'm going to be a little dogmatic since my people are that way. And I would say be careful about the potential for contextualization to actually end up cycling in on its own self. Because in a sense, by coming to a theological seminar like this and you meet this and this and this view changes, I kind of like this better. The belief in uniformity has created some of the cures for what might be the downside of congregationalism, and that is where you isolate your own ideas over there. There is maybe in uniformity and universalism kind of a naivete, but it does drive you out of your own culture. So I just would like to contextualize us, yes, but not too much that we miss out on growth that might be available. And even in one community, there can be a lot of difference. And you know, as I explore my own heritage, you know, how many of my Romanian Adventists were killed? You know, it just fascinates me that they were so dogmatic to stand up and be persecuted. I mean, as a Californian, I'm not used to that thinking, but it's kind of attractive. And yet, I wonder what distortions they had. I don't know, but it's just kind of like we have this amazing gift in earthen vessels, even culturally distorted vessels. And that's part of the joy of, you know, a worldwide church.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I agree with you. I tried to to suggest the idea that, in fact, for now we are too rigid on the universal side, and much less inclined to acknowledge the rights of the contextual side. So, if we run in any danger at the moment, it's not necessarily of the danger of excessive contextualization. But in fact, the problem is that you say the discourse of unity and keeping everything together. It's right, but are we really doing that? I make an example, and it may be very, from my standpoint, perspective, but it is what I lived. Romania is segregated by the rest of Europe. It constitutes half of the Euro-Africa division, 80,000 members, over 160,000. So they have a huge weight when it comes to decisions, at least numerically, and much less financially, because actually the weight is counted from the side of Germany, because Germany has the money, the wallet. But we are divided. Romanians will never invite a teacher from Friedensau, from Cologne, from Newbold to teach in Romania, because they consider that those seminars are westernized and are corrupted in a way, theologically bankrupt. They would invite people from Andrews University, from the seminary, because this is the flagship. It's the bigger place where Adventism, the genuine Adventism, is represented, and they look down upon other people who are from different contexts. That never invite a Norwegian or a Dutch or anyone else that will come.
They haven't invited me yet.
So. Right, and I'll tell them that. But I'm giving an example. Austria doesn't even send its young people to camporees at division level because they fear about the music and being corrupted by the Western influences. Are we really keeping it together? Or is it actually, is there a fracturing that is ongoing, and we actually assume that others are doing their thing, but we are not really talking to each other? So contextualization is happening no matter what we say. The point is when we, if we refuse to acknowledge it and also to try to heal the problems that the rhetoric of being all equal has caused, we may face a much worse situation. I mean, I very much agree with your perspective. We need to be around the table and not just try to manage, but actually respecting each other. But until we'll say that we need to be all equal, we won't respect each other, because if someone is slightly different, someone is in fault. So we really need to understand that it is already going on, and that we need to have a healthy conversation about those differences without playing the game, as I said before, of the winner and the loser in the battle. I don't know if I've answered that, but I very much agree about the fact that we need each other, because I may need, a Dutch may need a Romanian and may need to fight, but eventually they will come up changed and challenged in their respective positions.
Dr. Yeagley, you went a very different direction than I thought you would with the word blueprint, but you still ventured into dangerous territory. Thank you for your creativity and for this presentation. Don't forget the next forum's meeting on April 16, and if you'd like to come talk to Dr. Yeagley now, you can do that. Thank you, Dr. Yeagley.